The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 271, How My Profession Affects My Beliefs and Vice Versa, with panelists Dennis Nielsen, Roger Leshman, H. Wayne Scow, Hardy Reed, with the chair Del Johnson.
Welcome to Sunstone Session 271. Our panel this afternoon is entitled, How My Profession Affects My Beliefs and Vice Versa. We have four distinguished and very interesting panelists. I will introduce them in the order of their presentations. The first is Dennis Nielsen, who's an MD and a PhD. He was born in Los Angeles. He currently lives in Salt Lake City. He got a PhD in chemistry at the University of Utah in 1976 and his MD the same year. He had a residency in pediatrics at the University of California in San Francisco and then specialized in pediatric pulmonology. And he's currently associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Utah. He's published numerous articles and book chapters. His wife is Susan. He has three children and one granddaughter. Our second panelist is Roger Leshman. He resides in Chicago. He got his BA at the Brigham Young University in 1986, a JD at the Yale Law School in 1990. He's currently director of the Lesbian and Gay Rights Project for the ACLU of Illinois. Our third panelist is Wayne Scow, who resides in Pocatello, Idaho. He received his PhD in comparative literature at the University of Iowa in 1970. He's currently professor of English at Idaho State University, and he also has several publications, among which he co-edited Peculiar People, Mormons and Same-Sex Orientation. He has a book which is for sale out here, which he authored, entitled Remembering Brad, on the Loss of a Son to AIDS. And he has miscellaneous essays on 20th century literature. He has a wife, Sandra, four sons and eight grandchildren. And finally, Hardy Red. I was amused with his self-description, which you'll find in your program. Often cantankerous, usually responsible. He's an aging rancher. Hardy resides in LaSalle, Utah. He's been active in the Society for Range Management and briefly active in politics. He has 10 children. I asked Hardy to tell me something about himself over the phone. In his modesty, he says, well, it's a little like Winston Churchill said, he's a modest man and he has much to be modest about. Which shows you that he has a wonderful sense of humor because he can laugh about himself. With that, we'll ask Dennis Nielsen to begin. Our presentations will be roughly 15 minutes each, and that will give us 25 minutes for questions.
Thanks, Dale. School was easy for me from kindergarten through graduate school. I was and am a natural student. There is nothing I enjoy more than exploring ideas and learning new skills, and I am, I suppose, at times given to excess. A Bachelor of Science and PhD in Chemistry, a medical degree, pediatric residency, and pulmonary fellowship all contributed to a total of 27 years in school. And if it weren't for the need to earn a living and support my family, I probably would have gone on forever playing the intellectual Peter Pan.
Could you please put the mic closer to your mouth?
All right. I had been in graduate school for about 2 years working on a PhD in chemistry when I realized that there was little chance of landing a job at a university after I completed my training. Such positions were very scarce at the time, and for a while I had worked part-time for a physician involved in some medical research. And I did that to support my growing family. That was the sum of my exposure to medicine at the time, and in my relative ignorance, I decided that medicine held more promise of an academic career and a better income. I was not fully aware of what an academic or why an academic career was important to me. I really had no clue whether I would like dealing with the ill and dying. I had no concept of how hard medical school and the practice of medicine would be. There were no physicians in my family to serve as role models. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. My decision to attend medical school, like most of the really important decisions in my life, appeared on the surface at least as nearly accidental. Looking back almost 30 years, there was, I think, much less serendipity and a great deal more intuition in my decision than at first might appear to have been the case. I think I was in tune with my needs, and I followed my heart. Medicine has been the furnace in which the fire of my youthful ambition has burned. It has been a good place to test my resolve to make a difference, to contribute to a better world, to prove my worth. Early on, it fed my ambition, while at the same time confining it to activities that are useful, not harmful to others, and hopefully helpful to society. The Tao Te Ching, chapter 29. Do you think you can take over the universe and improve it? I do not believe it can be done. The universe is sacred. You cannot improve it. If you try to change it, you will ruin it. If you try to hold it, you will lose it. Medicine has provided me with the challenge of continual learning. I can never achieve mastery in medicine and stand still. There is continual movement and expansion and a strange feeling that every day is the first day of school. There are many rewards in my profession for focusing on medicine to the exclusion of all else. The overwhelming need to keep up in my professional life for years kept me from addressing my need to grow in other areas, including my spiritual life. Thank heaven for the so-called midlife crisis that forced me to reconsider the imbalance in my life that had gone on for almost 20 years. A midlife reevaluation saved my life. Being here with you today is one example of where I have departed from the monomaniacal perspective that is so easy to adopt as a physician. Medicine places me in a position of constant service to others and fulfills at least part of my need to feel a part of something greater than myself. I have a sense of purpose each day. I meet with my patients, and each day I work to better the medical care system. However, serving others can become mundane and common when it is so much a part of your life. But my patients remind me from time to time that there is no greater privilege or nothing more spiritual than helping others. People share with me their hopes and fears, their losses and gains, their darkest secrets, their strengths and imperfections, a kind of relationship with others possible in only a few professions. Because of this sharing, I experience a lot more of life than otherwise would be possible for me. People come to me with expectations of cure and comfort. Sometimes I can give them what they expect, and they are grateful. Their occasional disappointment with my limited power to heal provides me with opportunities to create more complex and meaningful relationships. Relationship to others is an important source of meaning in all our lives. Some argue that a personal relationship with God is possible and the most important relationship of all. I have a great deal of trouble with the concept of God and with relating to something or someone that I do not know, cannot see, and am not certain exists. Consequently, relationship with other people has become an even more important part of my spirituality. Medicine consumes a great deal of my life, and it can make it difficult to build the most important relationships, those with my wife and children and myself. I've had to choose between my profession and my family on several pivotal occasions, and I hope I have chosen well. Pain and loss are a part of everyday life. As a physician, I spend a great deal of time with these two great teachers. There is no greater grief than that of parents whose children die or have some lifelong deformity. Harold Kushner, in his book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, has said, It is one thing to explain that mortality is good for people in general. It is something else again to try to tell someone who has lost a parent, a wife, or a child that death is good. We don't dare to do that. It would be cruel and thoughtless. All we can say to someone at a time like that is that vulnerability to death is one of the given conditions of life. We can't explain it any more than we can explain life itself. We can't control it, or sometimes even postpone it. All we can do is to try to rise beyond the question, why did it happen, and begin to ask the question, what do I do now that it has happened? Often my job is to help people ask, what do I do now? I have no pat answers for them, only more questions. But living with such questions and the pain and loss they accompany is our greatest teacher in life. Being part of that process with others is an uncommon and great privilege. Accept disgrace willingly. Accept misfortune as the human condition. What do you mean by accept disgrace willingly? Accept being unimportant. Do not be concerned with loss or gain. This is called accepting disgrace willingly. What do you mean by accept misfortune as the human condition? Misfortune comes from having a body. Without a body, how could there be misfortune? Surrender yourself humbly, then you can be trusted to care for all things. Love the world as your own self, then you can truly care for all things. Tao Te Ching, Chapter 13. How many times have I been humbled by the limits of my skill and knowledge? Too many to count. Just when I think I have something down, the unexpected occurs or the landscape changes. The more I know I don't know. I suppose this might make me a little uneasy, but I hope it keeps me fresh and interested. It certainly keeps me from becoming too haughty. I hope it keeps me humble and worthy to care for all the families who come to see me. I am an imperfect man. I work with imperfect people. Those I serve at times are amazingly imperfect. I am forever and completely surrounded by imperfection. In order to find contentment, I must learn to love imperfection. And in fact, without imperfection, I would have nothing to do, nothing to build, no one to help, and little meaning in my life. Imperfection is a great gift, even though, as we should, we continually work to minimize it in our medical practice. The imperfection of the people we serve, over which we have no control, we try to embrace. I believe the Savior would approve. Of all personal values, integrity is the one I prize most, and it is also my greatest challenge. Becoming who I believe I am and who I want to be is very difficult. I have high expectations. There are many discontinuities in my life that I work to eliminate. I don't want walls between my professional and personal lives, between my secular and spiritual beliefs. It is my quest for integrity that does not allow me to separate science from my religion, and it is this value that has led to my personal brand of Mormonism. Although I believe all religion or spirituality is very personal, mine is certainly less traditional than most people who attend the Sunstone Symposium, where traditional belief does not square with what I believe to be true. I must stick with my truth. Where paradox exists and there is no simple truth, often the situation in this world, I reject simple answers and accept the paradox. Where I see no attainable answer to an important question, I live with uncertainty. There are physicians who are crass and uncaring. I know a number of them, and I suppose at times I have been one of them. There are physicians who are spiritual giants. I know some of them as well. They are not always who you might think. The best often receive little notoriety. Sometimes we all are like a man looking for a drink while standing in a fresh flowing stream. Medicine, as a profession, can provide many opportunities for spiritual growth, but we must see them. If we pay attention, amazing grace permeates our lives and our work. Medicine is not unique in this regard. Thank you.
I'd like to share a couple of simple narratives, the naked facts of my professional development and the naked facts of my spiritual development, both of which perhaps are odd for Sunstone, but ultimately all of our narratives are odd, I would suspect. And then I'd like to touch on two or three themes which I think connect them. Professionally, like Dennis, I was a born student, but perhaps not with as much direction as one would hope. I went to BYU because I couldn't think of anything else to do. I graduated and stayed for a year at grad school because I couldn't think of anything else to do. During that year, I taught English and was the founding editor of the independent student newspaper, Student Review, both of which were very important experiences for me. At the end of that time, I went to law school because I couldn't think of what else to do. And after 3 years of law school, I moved back to Seattle because I wanted to be home in the Northwest. I worked for a big law firm because I was broke and I couldn't think of anything else to do. After a couple of years of practicing there, I began exploring two different paths. I went back to grad school part-time in English literature and ultimately concluded that I wasn't at that time suited to that route. I also became involved on a pro bono basis as a lawyer with groups fighting anti-gay initiative campaigns, and sort of by happenstance got some experience in the political front there. And partly that experience to my current job, where I'm for the last 3 years have been a full-time gay rights and civil rights lawyer in Chicago for the American Civil Liberties Union. The narrative of my spiritual life, I grew up in a perfectly ordinary Mormon household, went to high school in a small town in Utah. I think that I was burdened by a very Old Testament worldview imposed on me, I don't know from where, a perfectionist pressure on myself that at the end of my time at BYU ultimately culminated in the same year of being an editor and being a teacher, a year where I was in turn losing my faith, becoming a nihilist, an atheist, suicidal, and at the end of that experience had a transformative religious encounter, became for the first time in my life, I really believe, a Christian, although I don't know exactly what it means to be a Christian, didn't then and don't now. Since then, when I was in law school, I looked at Mormonism and other faiths. I ended up attending Episcopal Church because I was an English major. It was a happy balance of tradition and modernity. Currently in Chicago, I don't attend regularly an Episcopal parish because I haven't found one I'm at home in, and I more often than not go to a Catholic service on Sunday nights, which is sponsored by the Archdiocese of Chicago for the lesbian and gay community, and every week has 500 gay and lesbian Catholics. I do this because I'm trying to understand why people in the Midwest are the way they are, and by being exposed to these people and their community, I feel I understand something about myself and something about them. The themes that I'd like to touch on, which for me connect these narratives, are first that I have the great blessing and great curse of having a vocation. That in the past I've had jobs, I've done things, but now I have a job that I really find to be a calling, to be a vocation. I'm doing something that I think is important and something that I'm destined to do. When I was in law school at Yale, my roommate was Martin Luther King Jr.'s nephew, who was a very gifted young man coming from a very black aristocracy family and very much burdened by the heritage that he had. And I remember very vividly, midway through law school, sitting around talking about how we wished that we'd been around in the 60s and how we bemoaned the fact that the great battles were no longer being fought, which is a silly thing to think when you're 23 years old, but I remember also vividly realizing that here I was, a gay man, not really fully aware of what that meant, and nevertheless recognizing and as time more and more recognizing that was the thing that was important to me, that the battle, the fights for justice, the fights in the law, the fights within my family and within my communities and the communities I belong to are centered on that very, very contested nexus. And so as I left the practice of normal law and came to the practice of the strange law that I do now, I did it with a sense of this is where I belong. This is what God wants me to do. And it's been a powerful part of my life that as frustrating sometimes as my job gets, that I come to it, and I don't know if I want to do this forever, because it is a terrible burden, but I do am grateful at this time to have this vocation. The second theme that I recognize in my development, and certainly where I am today, is that my vocation is profoundly inconsistent and at odds with other people's vocations. Some of you were here in the earlier panel in this room talking about the story of the feminist group at BYU and how painful that experience was, because the life of feminism is so much a contested area in the church and its communities. And if there's anything more painful, it is to be a gay rights activist or to be a lesbian or a gay man and to attempt to be part of this community. And yet, I look around at my colleagues at the ACLU. There are a couple of Jewish guys, a rabbi's son, some ex-Catholics. I'm the only person of my circle for whom religion is personally important. We fight all the time for the rights of religious people. If the Mormons and the ACLU had been around together 100 years ago, I would have been the one down there in Carthage getting the TRO. I mean, we are serious about religion as a fundamental value. But I look around at my colleagues, and no one else cares about it because it's important to them personally. They care about it because it's a fundamental part of a ordered liberty and life. But I just filed a big lawsuit last week. I represent a 9-year-old black boy who shared a snorkel in a pool with a white kid. When the white kid's mom found out, she pressured the community center into having my client tested for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, because she was afraid that her son could get AIDS because he shared a snorkel with a black kid. And so she pressured the community center. They pressured my clients into doing this. I tell you this because last Friday, before filing the lawsuit, we met one last time, and I, for the first time, met the community center director. It's a Christian ministry. He graduated from Div School 20 years ago. He has spent his whole life building a program for the youth and in the community in this horrible suburb outside of Chicago. And he wanted to come in and tell his story, and he started by telling the story of how God had called him to reach out to these people. And he just wanted to share that with me. He just wanted me to see that. And all the other lawyers in the room are not hearing anything. But I really could identify with this man who, for ignorance and prejudice, had done this very evil thing. So I sued him anyway. But I take what they're doing very seriously. But as I sue the Boy Scouts for keeping out atheists and gay people, as I fight over the issue of same-sex marriage and where we're going and all these things, on the other side of the table, so often I am working with people who really have a vocation too, who come there very sincerely believing what they're doing is so important, in the same way that I feel what I'm doing is so important. They're driven by the same way. And I think as I do my work, it has been helpful for me and also a struggle that I understand where they're coming from, and I'm doing what I'm doing fully aware of where they're coming from and why they're doing it. And yet, I believe that it's important for us both to be there at the table. I have enough time. Let me tell you about going to Catholic church, because it's amusing for me. I think if I were Catholic or had been Catholic, I wouldn't enjoy it at all. I think that it would sort of be like going to sacrament meeting now, which I find painful often. But I enjoy it in part because everyone thinks I'm Jewish. I go through life in Chicago as a gay rights lawyer who everyone thinks is Jewish. My family is Mormon. I'm Mormon on the books in part because I'm waiting for the church to do something that makes me really mad, and that hasn't happened enough yet. In part because I find amusing that when people ask if I'm Mormon, I technically have to say yes. And in part because it's important to my parents, and I respect that, and so I wouldn't act to hurt them without a good reason. But I also find in my life that the has been stripped away, and I come up with my core values. I am most comfortable in the Anglican community where I found myself and have stayed for 10 years. But I love going to Catholic Church in Chicago. And the reason for that is because 10 years ago, the Catholic Church in Chicago realized they had a problem with the gay community and what to do with it. There was an organization called Dignity, which is one of those rabble-rousing, let's make them ordain openly gay priests. They were just, they're very hungry people. And the Catholic Church kicked them off the church, wouldn't let them meet there, and it was sort of like being at BYU, and the church took a very BYU-esque stance in its response to this. And so every week now for the last 10 years, Dignity has met in a Methodist church around the corner, and I've been a couple of times, and they have about 25 people, and they have a folk mass with guitars, which is just really not something that I find spiritually helpful, but I'm sure that it's good for some people. But there they are every week, every 7 o'clock, every Sunday night, the Dignity people meet at the Methodist church. At the same time, at 7 o'clock every Sunday night, the Archdiocesan Gay and Lesbian Outreach, AGLO, AGLO meets. And the Archdiocese made a decision to sanction this meeting every week. They figured it would be better to have the gay people there in the flock where they could deal with them rather than out there chaining themselves to the fence or doing things like that. And it's a Catholic service. The official Catholic teachings are mentioned from time to time. And yet, I look at these people, and I look up there, and every week we have three kinds of sermons from the priests. We have the uncomfortable priest who just gives the same sermon he'd given that morning to all the people, all the normal families, and it's sort of like this awkward, here I am, talking about whatever, and these people are all gay. That occasionally happens. More often, we get the typical priest who's not gay. Well, he's not that typical then, but I mean atypical kind of priest who comes and basically talks about the mission of Christ and love, and in so many words talks about how the Catholic Church's doctrine are really inconsistent with that, and we all just will have to live with this and give lip service to it. But let's talk about service, or let's talk about justice. The third kind of sermon, which probably happens about as often, is the gay priest, who every week just loves to come and like casually mention that he's gay in the sermon, because it's just a comfortable space to be. And I enjoy these kinds of service, in part, as I've always done in going to services that are not Mormon, because they are so Christ-centered, because they're so much about love and service, but also because I'm sitting there with like one priest up there who's official and representing the church, and 500 of us, of them, because they're Catholic and I'm not. And after 10 years, they're still Catholic. They're also still gay and they're still lesbian. My friends in Chicago haven't changed. The church is being transformed. I think it's a frightening thing. I don't know if people in Rome knew about it, whether they would really tolerate it so much. But I have a vision of what it would be like in the Mormon Church, if there were a possibility of a space like that, where people can identify themselves as Mormon without having a litmus test, without having a long list of things, and even when they do disagree, to be allowed to do it there together with the music, with the discussion of Christ, and not be sent off to the Methodist Church and the guitars. I know it's impossible, but I'm at the same time, I'm so jealous of these people in Chicago, because that's their experience. And I go to this because I'm not Catholic, and so it doesn't bother me when they say something that would bother them. And because I do love being in a community that is a community of Christ, the body of Christ, that talks about nothing but being the body of Christ and what that means to them. I'd like to close with a couple of related metaphors, which are very important to me in my life. When I was in Seattle, I was in the cathedral choir at St. Mark's Episcopal Cathedral, which is a wonderful place and a great place to sing. And it also teaches you the whole idea of preaching to the choir. It's totally backwards, because the choir is sitting up there like doing their nails and being cynical. If you can reach the choir, you are hot. But I also had 5 years of singing the great music of the West, which is something that Mormons are not exposed to. But I also got the experience of a community that was so Christ-centered and was so into justice and to outreach, which is part of my own vacation as a lawyer working for justice. But the priest there was a wonderful woman who, For 15 years, she was the general manager of the Big Apple Circus, and she was married to a man who turned out to be gay. They were still good friends. They were divorced. He and his lover died of AIDS. This is a woman who's had an extraordinary, rich life. But she talked in one sermon that was very important to me about her vision of life as a great expanse where we travel in caravans, and you may not end the journey with the caravan you started in. And as we pass through this, people have different experiences. And the image that resonated for me is the idea that you travel with and are with the caravan that shares your song. And as I've gone through my life, and it has been transformed in large part because of the things that I've done and devoted my life to, I've always been listening for those songs that resonate, the themes in Mormonism that are still so profound to me, the themes that I find elsewhere. But as I look for the songs that I recognize, I realize how stripped away they are, that my life is so centered on the central Christian message, the central imagery. I have very little interest in an afterlife. That's a great gift because a lot of people care and are afraid. I really don't care or know much about it. It's not important about my life. But as I hear about Christ every week in church, as I represent this 9-year-old black kid, as I sue the Boy Scouts, for me it does come back to these central images of the outcast, of reaching out, of a perfect love. So that's the final metaphor. I love to hear quoted Dallin Oaks' famous proverb of the dogs bark, but the caravan moves on. And that truly is something that I have adopted for myself, that things have been stripped away from my life, as they are in all of our lives. And you hear yapping of different kinds, but I do have a vision. I have a vision of justice and love and a better world in this world. And that is what makes it possible for me to do my work. It's profoundly based in religion, based in Mormonism, based in Christ. Even though the things I believe in are so minimal now, they nevertheless are so profound that they are my vocation. I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak to you, and I know it's odd. I'm not your typical Sunstone presenter. This is not an ACLU venue, and nevertheless, I appreciate the fact that if there is a space like a glow in Mormonism, this is it. And I'm so grateful that we all are permitted to be in a place where we can begin to share and yet be ourselves. Thank you.
I'm so used to feeling like in any group of church people that I'm way over on the left side. And now after these two speakers, I almost feel a little bit closer to the center. I am happy to be here with you, and I feel like I'm among friends when I come to Sunstone. It's a pleasure for me to share time with these presenters who have preceded me. I must say, I'm dreadfully envious of people who can get up and speak apparently extemporaneously. I mean, I know that it was well prepared, but without notes. But then I'm an academic, and so you expect me to come with my manuscript. I signed on for this discussion thinking that the topic would be interesting and easy to address. I was dead wrong about easy. The subject is surprisingly broad for me and complex. In striving for both brevity and sufficient explanation, I have achieved neither. In fact, my religion was probably responsible for getting me into the language and literature business in the first place. As a pre-architecture major in college, I was called on a mission to Denmark. From the outset, the historical and cultural richness of Europe engaged my sensibilities, expanded my worldview, and allowed my latent interest in the humanities and the arts to emerge. As a result, on my return, I declared a new major in comparative literature and determined to pursue a career in college teaching. that choice of an unanticipated career path has made all the difference. I cannot even imagine what my present spiritual life would be apart from the influence of my professional life. Since I can't burden you with the whole narrative, I'm going to give you briefly 8 observations on how sustained engagement with language and literature have affected my present religious views, and touch briefly on my practice as a teacher. 1. Unquestionably, my approach to theological and spiritual questions has been influenced by the attitude toward knowledge and by the methods of inquiry that are traditional in university studies. Like the sciences, the humanities disciplines, including my field of literary study, pursue knowledge liberally. That is, with creative freedom to investigate, to evaluate, and to theorize. To this end, they teach skills of precise observation and description, and they employ disciplined reason in evaluating evidence. In general, academic inquiry concerns itself with epistemological questions. What can we claim to know, and by what means? Accordingly, its pursuit of knowledge is accompanied by a healthy dose of skepticism that resists truth claims unsupported by evidence. Such discipline acknowledges genuine ambiguity where it exists and concedes that evidence may support more than a single explanation. What has been accepted as working truth is always subject to revision in the light of new discovery. In my attempts to formulate spiritual beliefs, in my assessment of theological dogmas, I consider these academic tools invaluable. I do recognize, of course, that spiritual matters frequently lie beyond empirical demonstration, beyond rational proof. But like Kierkegaard, if at certain points I choose to leap irrationally into the abyss of faith, I wish not to confuse that position with certain knowledge. 2. My professional study has encouraged me to view theology and spiritual experience from a broad, inclusive perspective. I operate on a hypothetical premise that all truth, if properly understood, is ultimately unified and coherent, at least theoretically for God. If this premise is true, some kind of meta-theory would be helpful as we seek to understand how everything fits together. The physical and the metaphysical, the ethical and the aesthetic, the desires of the individual and the claims of the collective, etc., and how all of these relate to the meaning of history. Most human beings want to find a satisfying meta-theory, doubtless because we are psychologically constituted to find chaos intolerable. John Milton, one of the most learned men of his time, consciously attempted in Paradise Lost to bring all human history and knowledge under a single explanatory framework, to show how all heathen cultures, including classical Greece and Rome, are subsumed under the great unifying meaning of Christianity. Clearly, Milton recognized that an adequate meta-theory must account for all the details of history, that it cannot simply ignore whatever is not conveniently assimilatable. In Denmark, I began to be aware how daunting is the challenge faced by conscientious, careful meta-theorists. I was an inheritor of the Christian meta-theory, as interpreted by LDS theology, and as a general touchstone, it seemed largely workable. But clearly there would need to be some interpretive flex in it. With so much more to incorporate since Milton, the task had become even more complex. Already in the mission field, my intuitive belief in God's practicality and fairness left me scrambling to find ways of reconciling one true faith with all the religious paths that humans have trod. I concluded then that I must henceforth embark on measuring Mormon Christianity against all the relevant evidence from human history that I encountered, obviously a long and labor-intensive project. Literature would be the ideal vehicle for my larger pursuit. It could expand my vicarious experience enormously in both time and space. It would extend my awareness of the incredible variety of individual human beings, their philosophies, their aspirations, their emotions, their daily circumstances, more than I could ever encounter directly. As a student, it dawned on me that the study of literature is perhaps the most eclectically comprehensive of the disciplines. It touches religion, philosophy, history, psychology, sociology, even physical science, as well as the sister arts. To study literature would be to study all of these to some degree and to have the benefit of their insights. From that point on, every book or article I read, every poet's observation, every critic's opinion, every theorist's framework was measured against my evolving and ultimately highly personal interpretation of my religion-based meta-theory. 3. If all knowledge is unified, a corollary seemed to me to be that ideally all facets of a life should be interconnected, integrated in a self-consistent whole, the parts clarifying and supporting one another. This ideal integration includes professional activity, which consumes a major portion of one's time and contributes significantly to one's sense of identity. How fortunate I have been to have the luxury, I think it is a luxury, of a profession in which contemplation of the human condition and human values is virtually a daily occupation. Teaching others for a living has been rewarding, but from the outset, my principal motive for choosing this profession was that it would allow me to be a lifelong student of what seemed to be of greatest interest and importance to me. 4. I'm justified by Latter-day Saint Scripture in seeking spiritual enlightenment in the diversity of secular literature. Joseph Smith, who was prodigiously eclectic in his own right, was surely inspired when he wrote the wonderful 13th Article of Faith. Its general tenor is eclectic, outward-looking, expansive. If there is anything virtuous, lovely, or of good report, or praiseworthy, we seek after these things. That article emboldens me to regard certain spiritual insights from Dostoevsky, André Gide, and Simone Weil, for example, as inspired and prophetic. It legitimizes my acceptance of Kierkegaard and Gerard Manley Hopkins and John Donne as teachers central to my Christian life path. The spiritual value in written texts, I believe, has less to do with canonization than with the way it resonates in the soul of the individual reader. 5. My study and observation have made an existentialist of me. I am grateful to Kierkegaard for a compelling example of how this philosophical position can be compatible with Christianity. He showed me that one can acknowledge uncertainty and still make the movements of faith, that faith necessarily implies uncertainty. He helped me understand the challenge of individual responsibility in Christian living and the danger of regarding Christianity as a secure group enterprise. The ways literature represents human experience is to be brought, sooner or later, up against the nature of the medium, language per se. Most people take language for granted. They assume that it presents experience directly and unambiguously. They assume it is a transparent, primarily literal medium, uncomplicated in some kind of pure referentiality. But when you root around in literary texts long enough and rigorously enough, and when you compare the ways they communicate, it becomes clear that the fact is otherwise. In its very essence, language is problematic. To a surprising degree, language is symbolic and figurative, especially where our feelings and our non-empirical metaphysical concerns come into play. Abstract thought is so vague that it quickly drives us into metaphorical analogy. Everyday speech is so laden with buried figures that scarcely a sentence can be uttered without it containing one or two. If Nietzsche is correct, we are caught in a prison house of language, the inherent limitations of which we cannot transcend. Incidentally, the prison house of language is a famous phrase. It really did not come out that way with Nietzsche. Nietzsche said we are constrained. He said we have to think within the constraints of language. And one of his more famous translators rendered that idea of constraint as a metaphor, a prison house, and now most everyone thinks that's the way that Nietzsche said it. But it illustrates the point of how language slips in figurative directions when you're hardly paying attention. The upshot of this is that theology, philosophy, and history, expressible only in language, are inherently ambiguous and subject to interpretation. And of course, in this, the sacred texts are not exempt. More than anything else, my attempts to read and understand the standard works helped me understand the problematic nature of language, its figurative indirection, its inescapable imprecision. I found, and still find, the scriptures fascinating in their linguistic complexity. I found, and still find, challenge in attempting to ferret out the significant truths that lie beneath their inconsistent figurative surfaces. Judaism and some strains of Christianity have long recognized these linguistic complexities and have developed sophisticated hermeneutical approaches to religious texts. We Mormons have been slower in developing a body of theological scholarship and scriptural commentary, due in part to the evangelical epistemological underpinnings of our religious heritage, in part to our relative youthfulness as a major religion. Applying this view of language to the scriptural text has made me more ecumenical. If much scriptural detail is, in fact, figurative or symbolic rather than literal, then much surface conflict with other religions substantially evaporates. For example, if texts relating to baptism are primarily about spiritual rejuvenation and employ metaphors of rebirth and cleansing to that end, then arguments about sprinkling and immersion cease to be important. Similarly, the gathering of Israel, the millennium, and Christ's second coming have deeper and more important spiritual implications, it seems to me, than the issue of literal historicity. The surface symbol should not be mistaken for the real point. The figurative scaffold used in constructing the edifice of spiritual enlightenment should not be mistaken for the building itself. In short, my assumptions about Scripture, its limitations, and its legitimate uses have been profoundly affected by my professional study. 7. So where does this professional endeavor leave me, for better or worse? Doubtless some will find me impossibly orthodox, will say I have lost faith and am no longer truly a Latter-day Saint. I am persuaded, on the contrary, that my spiritual life is engaged and healthy, and I would not wish it otherwise. If the matter be carefully considered, I hold that faith is ultimately more an individual than a group matter anyway, that there are as many versions with subtle or not so subtle variations, as many nuanced meta-theories as there are individuals. My study and observation have impressed me with the enormous diversity in the world, not least in the way humans have attempted to recognize the divine in their lives. I have come gradually to see integrity and richness and beauty in spiritual endeavors that in form and expression are vastly different from my own. I believe that God intended this diversity to be so, and my admiration for the creative imagination of God has grown as a result. My study of texts, canonical and otherwise, persuades me that we are individually and collectively caught up in an evolutionary process, which I take to be consistent with the doctrines of continuing revelation and eternal progression. And that is, and I believe that not very much in our present level of understanding is final. I am persuaded that simple is not a good word to describe humans or history, or more specifically, our evolving attempts to apply the gospel of Jesus Christ in the world. But I am comfortable in the face of complexity and uncertainty, happy to live by existential faith and trust in God's good purposes. Finally, 8. Given such unorthodox beliefs, what is my stance in relation to my students, many of whom are LDS, most of whom are Christian in some way or other, and virtually all of whom are searching for a meta-theory to live by? I recognize that most of them at this stage would be more grateful for certainties than for the existential uncertainty I espouse. I recognize also the inequality in our relationship and my disproportionate opportunity to influence them by virtue of my credentialed status and longer experience. I try to remember what it was like for me early on, how I wrestled to hold on to faith as I encountered new and compelling intellectual insights, how my pursuit of a personal set of beliefs proceeded deliberately, one step at a time, as I was ready. I try accordingly to respect each individual's unique spiritual journey. I am not seeking converts for my views among students. I do not try to hurry anyone. I examine evidence with students, but I try not to hammer them with my conclusions. They can draw their own if and when they are ready to do so.
Well, I have to say one thing. If my wife were here, she would somewhat disagree with that story that Winston Churchill mentioned about humility. I don't think she'd call me humble, knowing me well. I'm a transhumanist, a person who follows livestock on their annual trek from winter range to summer range and back again. And I'm the best manure for a piece of land. My early beliefs were in being raised in a liberal Mormon household, with the universe was basically a fair, just, benign, and friendly place. That there was in it a law of compensation, that things had to be earned. It did not give things without work. I also was raised parenthetically with the idea, and have the idea, that integrity is the most important personal value, the most difficult part of which is honesty with oneself. I had hoped when I was young, or believed when I was young, that the universe was a universe of law, a clock, which was started by God. It was cold and exacting, fair. We have to pay the price, and we get what we put in. The realities of the ranching business and of nature have blurred the distinctions, and the world is not quite so much black and white as it was. The realities are still there. There is no, like it or not, there is no romance in nature. We put romance into it. If there is no rain in southeastern Utah, there are no crops. The hard realities of being bucked off a horse when the mass of the earth creates gravity that attracts a body, and it's like Sancho Panza says in
Namacha. Whether the pitcher of water strikes the stone or the stone strikes the pitcher of water, it's bad for the pitcher. And all the romance in the world can't overcome the realities of nature. I'm a little bit like, again, from a musical, The King and I, when the king sings, the things that I knew were true, I don't know quite so much are true. A few years ago, I thought I was having difficulty with a lot of elk, which were planted on our area, and there's nothing that I could do about them on Forest Service land or BLM land, but I felt like they were damaging the range, and I thought I had good scientific information that it was, so I invited the folks from Utah State Range Science Department down, and we rode across our range, and immediately before we started out to ride, I mentioned what I'd learned at Utah State in range science in 1960-61. And as we were sitting there on our horses before we started out, there was kind of an embarrassed silence among the range science guys that were there, and they said, "Well, Hardy, we really hate to tell you this, but what we told you 30 years ago is no longer true. And we have a different theory about how plants operate. And your premises are based on what you learned 30 years ago, and that's no longer the theory which we accept in range science." Well, that was a shock to me, as a way a lot of things have been a shock to me. But there are some things that are true in the universe. When a person wants to reseed an area artificially, put some seeds on a piece of land, he has to first start with good seed. It can't have a lot of weeds in it. The soil has to have tilth and fertility. The seeds have to be planted not too deep or not too shallow. They have to be covered generally, and they have to receive some moisture. If any of these things go wrong, you get a crop failure. There were some fires a couple, 3 years ago down by Cove Fork. And I looked at them last year, and there was some pinyon juniper that had burned. The trees were all dead. And in some places, the grass was growing pretty well. They had receded. In other places, there wasn't any grass. And I said, "Well, what's the difference?" Well, they said, "On this side, you'll notice all the dead pinyon juniper trees are laid over, because when we reseeded by air, we scattered the seed everywhere. And then we covered the seed and stirred the soil with a chain drug between two caterpillars that pulled the trees over, but it covered the seed. And that this is the point where the grass is growing, the so-called environmentalists stopped us from covering the seed. And so even though we put seed over here," there's a great metaphor in the Bible, something about falling on sterile, bare ground, hard ground. Even though the seed was put on, even though there was rainfall, the necessary business of covering the seed with a little soil wasn't complied with. And there was a failure of seed, and consequently a great deal more erosion of the soil. One of the things I've learned in my profession, that life is tenacious and rare. One of the great stories that I've heard from Steve Rich, after we had done some environmental education with some folks, and they said, "Well, philosophize a little bit. What's the basis on which you believe in holistic resource management and the way you want to manage range?" And he said, "We were up on the mountain, and He says, as I look out in the universe, there may be a lot of life out there, but the rarest, I see a lot of material, I see a lot of energy, I see a lot of space. But the rarest thing I see in the universe is life. That's the rarest thing I see. And he was standing right above a cow paddy that was about 5 or 6 days old, and it's a little bit like, forgive me for being too graphic, but it's a little bit like, it gets on a skim on it, kind of like tomato soup does after it's cooled. And, but anyway, here was this cow paddy that was kind of hard on top, but very soft and fresh underneath. And he took his shoe and just scraped the top of that off, and you could see dung beetles, which were doing their job, breaking this dung down so it could be recycled and used. And you could see them crawling to get out, away from the sunlight. And he said, to me, that's really beautiful. That's really beautiful. He didn't use these terms, but I will. There are creatures fulfilling the measure of their creation, doing what they should be doing, and making, in part, life possible for us. That life, because it's rare in the universe, and all life on this world, is, to him, was the most beautiful thing and the thing that ought to be preserved. Well, out of that story, I gained an appreciation for nature that it's taken me a long time to come to. I've learned that animals or plants, and the life I can observe on the ranch, and this may apply to human beings too, but have two main objectives. They do a lot of other things too. But one of the things I've noticed about life, whether it's plants or animals, is all life wants to survive. When a lamb is born, it'll suck anything. It'll grab little pieces. It's trying to find a teat. Let me suggest, so did you. To survive, we wouldn't be here unless our ancestors tried to survive and did survive. The other thing we try to do, maybe without realizing it, is to perpetuate our species. A young calf, teenager, tries to mount anything that it can. The end is the perpetuation of the species. The means, I think, for us and for animals, I don't know about plants, I haven't asked them, but the means that either the Lord or evolution has provided is we enjoy sexual pleasure. So we breed to keep the species going. That may be somewhat unromantic, but essentially I see that all through the plant and animal kingdoms. We and animals do a lot of other things too, but those two basic things are the things that keep life on this planet going. Animals and plants function best in an environment of freedom. The metaphor I use is that we used to brand our calves and then we'd gather them up and move them, herd them, for a couple of miles and then put them through a gate. And if any of you have ever done that, where you've got a calf that's sore, he's probably been branded, castrated, had an earmark cut out, been injected. What else do we do to them? Seems like there's some other thing. Dehorn him. So he's kind of feeling kind of sorry for himself, and And he wants to lay down. It's hot. All he wants to do is lay down. He's in pain. His mom is being pushed along by these cowboys, and he is, and he doesn't want to suck. He doesn't want to mother up. And if you don't mother him up before you put him through a gate, then they can get separated, and the calf can be dogged. Well, we devised a new system, moved the corral, and made it so, put some fences in so the livestock, we didn't have to worry about them getting on the highway. And essentially what we do is when the calf is branded, it goes out and finds its mother. And they go at their own speed to the mountain. Sometimes they may take 5 days, sometimes 2 days. One of the most beautiful sights in the world is to see a cow early in the morning with her calf behind her. Nobody's pushing her. She's not being harassed. But going at her own speed and the speed that her calf is willing to go, that's her freedom to move at her speed and her time where she wants to go. I'm convinced that that is a good thing for human beings. It's good for us to have freedom. In fact, I don't believe we can develop as fully as we should unless we have freedom. Diversity, I've learned that diversity is important. I didn't used to like diversity. One of the scourges that I've had in my mind in the past is sagebrush. I mean, there's coyotes and prairie dogs and other things too, but I wanted to have a pure stand of crested wheatgrass, which is an alien species from Russia of grass, and I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if we could just eliminate all the sagebrush? Well, we got that done on a piece of land, and we found a funny thing. Nature doesn't like monocultures. And what happened was, is that it created such a good food source for a bug called the black bug, that they multiplied exponentially and started killing the crested wheatgrass. And pretty soon, here was a little place where a sagebrush plant could get started, and it started to grow. And I decided if nature and the Lord wanted diversity, I guess I had to give some diversity. There's some other practical things I learned. I wanted to get rid of the sagebrush because I thought the other plants were more productive. That's true if it never snows. But if you get a deep snow and only the sagebrush sticks above the ground, then cows and sheep do better on something they can eat rather than something that's buried underneath the snow. I had to learn that by experience. The same thing is true of oak brush. I'd like to get rid of all the oak brush until I recognized that in a drought year, the only place there was grass that wasn't dried up was underneath the canopy of the oak brush. I've learned that the pampered and the hothouse plants or people don't survive as well as those subject to stress. In 1964, we had a terrific snowstorm, and we couldn't get it into our cows or our sheep for about 3 weeks, and there were caterpillars, and they were flying hay and doing all kinds of things, and they asked my father if he wanted some hay flown to his cattle, and he said, I'll start to feed the cattle when they're standing on their hind legs, reaching at the top of the trees to get something to eat. And I thought, that's really stupid. That's really stupid. We had a practice of not supplementing with hay our range cattle if we could avoid it. A month went by, the snow melted. Our neighbor's cattle, right next door, he had the practice of putting his cows out in the wintertime and then bringing them in March and feeding them every spring, feeding them hay. Well, as quick as he got into them, he took them some hay the middle of December. And then the snow went off, and those cows stayed right there where that last hay was fed, his cows. And they stayed there, and they started to starve to death, even though the snow was gone and there was plenty of grass. They figured it was time to go on the dole. And so he had to gather those cattle and take them back to his ranch and feed them hay. I think, Leonard, this is true of people too, that we can't subsidize people too much, or we can't spoil children too much. It's not good for them. I love the implications, and I'll just glancingly mention, I love the implications that this has for the Endangered Species Act. Maybe by trying to protect endangered species, we're ultimately saying to them, or making them so weak that they can't survive in real life. How much time have I got? Have I done? Okay. Two more things. Animals, including us, are self-interested. There does operate a survival of the fittest. Animals are cooperative, as are human beings. One of the fun books I've just read is called The Origins of Virtue by a zoologist who posits that cooperation among human beings is an innate trait, as much or more so than selfishness. I see this in livestock when I see one cow and 12 calves. You ride out, here's one cow and 12 calves, and you think, what's going on? What's going on is the other mamas have gone to get a drink of water at the reservoir, and they've left this old gal there babysitting to protect these young calves from any predators or anything untoward might happen. And then when they come back, she'll go to water. Two last things. Nature is very complex. We understand it poorly. It's best to deal with nature in any of its aspects with a great deal of humility and tentativeness. Finally, I've learned a lesson that my father tried to teach me, that the best rewards in life, in the ranching life anyway, are not material, and they're not security. I thought that once I got out of debt, I could be happy. It wasn't true. My father used to say, the real rewards you're going to get from ranching is to see the improvement in the land under your hand, and to see improvement in livestock, to have them be more productive and more useful. I would add to that to see the growth in your children, and to also see, and it's been alluded to here, to get the benefits of human relationships. One of those associations that I have is at Sunstone, where I can associate with people who are willing to be open-minded and question themselves. And I appreciate that association. To see improvement in land, to see improvement in livestock, to see improvement in your own offspring, your children, and to develop good relationships with people, those are really I've learned to appreciate that those are really the reward of the real rewards of the ranching business. And essentially, that's one of the things that Christ teaches, that those are the things that are more important than material things. Thank you.
Thanks to all of you who presented. We've heard some really fascinating personal statements, and they're diverse and sophisticated. And the question is, are they controversial? They're very personal. Do you have questions? We have about 18 minutes, and I'm sure our presenters would be happy to expand on their statements if you have questions for them.
If you don't, I'll say something provocative.
Go for it.
That's my question.
All right.
What do you have to say that's provocative?
Well, we got a real question.
More lessons from livestock, Hardy.
Well, maybe this is the same
I wondered if you could elaborate just a little bit on how your experiences with nature and arriving at your value system in your work, how has that affected your activity in the church or your spiritual life or your personal creed?
Let me have you come to the microphone because this is being recorded, and I'll just repeat this initially, and then actually I would ask you, well, I can bring the microphone to you, but it's very helpful to speak into the microphone because of the recording. As I understand the question, how have your experiences on the ranch and working with animals and with nature really affected your relationship in the church, in the LDS church?
Well, I think in some ways, working with nature, I've become, more humble and more as humble as I can become. So I've become more cynical because I've worked with people and I've found out there are some people I can trust and some that I can't. One of the things that I like is that land and livestock are always honest. They may not do what you want them to. Sheep particularly they're the one exception to that all animal and plant life wants to survive. Because there's an expression in the sheep business that a sheep is born that spends the rest of its life trying to die. But I think maybe it enhances my and I get part of this from my father. I'm sure he got it, and I get it from my religion, is that integrity where either the land or the livestock or human beings present themselves as they are. They don't try to pretend that they're more than they're not. And I'll take the greatest sinner in the world if he kind of lets me know what he is, because I can deal with that. One of the things I love about nature is that it validates, I think, the principle of integrity, which I think is the principal value of the gospel. The only thing that Christ got mad at people about is when they were dishonest. So that's just one area that where it's made my religion more meaningful.
Do you find that in the church a lot?
Oh, I find both things. And one of the things that I've learned in the church that I have to do is not to judge. I just love to judge other people, particularly if they're committing a sin that I don't commit. You know, I love to judge other people. I rode here this morning with a young lady who works at an auto repair shop, and we got to visiting about things, and she says, you know, the ward we lived in before, we lived in an apartment, and it was kind of a single family home half and an apartment half, the population was. She said, you know, those people that lived in single family homes really looked down on us people that lived in the apartments. And I felt bad about that. I felt bad about the fact that there was this discrimination and kind of this snobbery. My father taught a Sunday school class once, and he said, we Mormons have a chosen people complex. We're smug, self-satisfied, we have the only true church, and we act like it. Then he paused for effect and said, but we're right. We are the chosen people if we choose to be. That's the hard job, is to choose to treat people and not judge them. I immediately judged that ward and then realized that I probably shouldn't have done it. A corollary to that, and this is something that just came up a couple of weeks ago, we had a young couple moved to LaSalle, which is just a small branch. And they were just newly married and just starting out with their life. And she was a member who had been inactive, was inactive, and he was not a member. And I was touched by the fact, I didn't think we were this good, but I was touched by the fact that he joined the church and they've been taking lessons and are moving toward the new Monticello temple. And she said, "We wouldn't have changed unless you people in LaSalle accepted us for what we were. And we've been in wards where people death. And we expected the same here." I'm guessing that's one of the challenges we have. I have in my own life, and I think we all have as LDS, is to do some of the things the Catholics and the Methodists and the Baptists do a lot of times, is to accept other people for what they are and have some tolerance for them. And that, you can't fake it. You know, it has to be in your heart. We have to reach out for people in our wards. They know if we think, they know if I think that I'm better than they are. They can feel it. Well, thanks.
Anyone else?
There's been a...
Do you mind coming up?
No, I but I'll make it a speech, so then it won't be a question. I don't want to hear me. But.
I'm hearing this theme of humility washed about personal integrity and congruity. And I'm wondering, as you get older, or as you form your own picture, I'm thinking mainly to Dennis and Wayne, does that get easier? Do you ever find it, I'm humble now, or I have integrity now? What happens over time? And then I have a quick question for Roger, and that is, you use the word vocation with such personal attachment, more so than I think profession, and I'm wondering the etymology of that word to you, what that really means, and whether you meet people regularly who look at their vocation as you do.
The humility question, I don't know how to answer that one. I think it's true that as you move along in life and have more experience, that at least I think I've tended to become more humble. I don't expect to set the world on fire anymore. That may be the fading of testosterone. I hope it's experience. And I hope it's real. I mean, I hope this isn't a misperception on my part. But how do you know? The question about integrity, I think that I lived my life for many years putting up walls, dividing my spiritual life from my professional life or my developing professional life. And it was the only way I could really remain a mainstream Mormon because I was being inundated with all kinds of science and a belief system that required rigorous questioning and solid evidence for taking a stand. Frankly, you know, the church is still stuck in some, you know, with some really with some bad science. You know, people still talk about Dr. Cook up at Utah State and his questions about the age of the Earth. I mean, you know, this is just not even a relevant argument in any scientific community. And so, you know, let's sort of, you know, my feeling about it is, let's get over it. You know, the Earth is billions of years old, and the proof for that, or the evidence for that, is extremely strong. And evolutionary thought, you know, I mean, I hear, I have one child who's still very active in the church, you know, we stay away from these discussions, but I hear these things about, you know, about evolutionary or Darwinism, you know, and how it's an evil thing and all that. I mean, my gosh, there's more evidence for Darwinian theory than there is for the theory of electromagnetism. And, you know, we use that to build VCRs and television sets and to light our houses. But it's only a theory, right? But it works pretty well. So I did that for many years, and I just got to a point, and I think it took me a long time because I'm very steeped in the church. I have pioneers on both sides. My father came from South Central Utah, from a farming community, handcart pioneers, and all of that. And I tried so hard for so many years to be to be a really mainstream Mormon, and to I had those 100% pins they used to give out, to teenage. I had six of those. I used to go to church when I was deathly ill so I could get my pin because it was the right thing to do, But it just finally got to a point, probably, it was an evolutionary thing, but, around 40, it really kind of hit me really hard, and I just finally had to say, I can't do this anymore. I've got to smash down the walls, and there can't be any division between my professional life and my religious life and my family life. It's got to be a continuum, and it's all got to fit and somehow work together and make sense. So I think the integrity was something that also was evolutionary and has become more and more important.
Could you elaborate just a little bit? Ethnic, the great, whatever it was, the whiteness or crisis, whatever you pointed around 40. What did you do about the synthesis of reconciliation? Did you do the easy thing, quick white church? How do you handle that? You don't mind my
asking. Did I do the easy thing, quit going to church when I had my epiphany? It was the question. Well, it's not flip. It's actually close to what happened. The drift away from mainstream traditional Mormonism was very gradual. And there were certain pivotal events that happened. And at the time, some of those events, I didn't realize that what they were or what it was that happening. Like when I was 18 and I was confronted by a colleague of, I was working in the stock, well, I say colleague, I was working in the stockroom at JCPenney's in Pomona, California, right? So one of the assistant managers, who happened to be a very nice, bright, young black man, came to me and asked me about why Mormons didn't ordain blacks into the priesthood, and so I had to regurgitate the dogma that I had learned in church. And at the end of that, the thing that I remember now looking back was I felt so bad about it. I felt it was so wrong, and I felt so rotten. And I think that that was one of the points where there was a crack in my traditional faith that developed. But there were a whole series of events, and there were some pivotal events, but It was an evolutionary process.
Well, help me out here. You say you're not a mainstream Mormon. I consider myself not a mainstream Mormon, but I go to church every Sunday. I check all the boxes, whatever. What do you mean by?
Well, I don't attend. And one of my favorite chapters in one of my favorite books is titled "Why I Am a Pagan." So that would give you some idea of where I am.